A charm invests a face imperfectly beheld. The lady dare not lift her veil for fear it be dispelled, but peers beyond her mesh and wishes and denies, lest interview annul a want that image satisfies. This answers the question as to why ladies wear veils, right? Because a woman looks enigmatical, mysterious, beautiful often. And if she takes off the veil, then maybe some of the heaven forfend blemishes appear. So the idea, very simple, very straightforward, very feminine, the poem is the wiles that women use. Here's one that moves into another aspect of women's appeal, women's relationships with men. Look, considered quite daring when it first came out. Did the harebell loose her girdle to the lover bee? Would the bee the harebell hollow, much as formerly? Did the paradise persuaded yield her moat of pearl? Would the Eden be an Eden? Or the Earl an Earl? Let me try that one again. Harebell is a flower. So we're talking about a sexy relationship between the flower and the bee, right? Pretty heavy symbolism, right? For boy-girl kind of relationships. What ought the proper relationship be between this flower and this bee? How circumspect should the flower be? Did the harebell loose her girdle to the lover bee? Would the bee the harebell hollow, much as formerly? Did the paradise persuaded yield her moat of pearl? Would the Eden be an Eden? Or the Earl an Earl? Well, first stanza really is talking about, in a sense, they're both meaning the same thing. I guess the question that the adolescent young woman's question of her date might be summarized as, will you respect me if I do? Will I lose your respect? Remember a response from that from Mike Nichols being in some of his routines with Elaine May, when he would say, when they did a skit on this, and he said, oh, yes, I'll respect you even more if you do. So carrying this now to this really cute degree of talking about this relationship as being also transferable to a flower, and the bee, will the bee respect the flower if the flower permits sex? And then carrying it further, if the paradise were yielded, paradise being her virtue, flower's virtue, to yield her moat of pearl, her precious virginity, assumedly, would the Eden be an Eden? Would it be the paradise that's dreamed of? Would it be the wonder that sex is assumed by the adolescent girl or the harebell flower to be? And would the male who would then accept her be all he was expected to be? Or might he turn out not to be all he seemed to be? This is the stuff of novels. How many novels could you go into our library here and find which have this basic thesis? Should she or shouldn't she? Every mother and her daughter have discussions about this, I assume. Goodness knows, my wife and my daughters do. The old-fashioned style, of course, was always to say, wait, 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 patience, patience, patience. You should never yield your virginity to marriage. That tends to be seen as a bit old-fashioned these days, and yet, some of us old-fashioned fathers feel that it's still a course of action most desired by women, because most of us have memories long enough to know back when we were courting young women and what our attitude with respect to the very issues that Emily Dickinson talks about here. How about the respect? Will you respect me if I do? Will you respect me if I do? Answer, often, heck no. Very old-fashioned response, right? Very old-fashioned response. Emily Dickinson doesn't give a response. But the implicit question is, this obtains for even a harebell and a bee. Should she or should she not? When in doubt, harebell, don't. I think that's what she'd say. I don't know. That may be an inference. That may be not fair. Emily Dickinson almost certainly was a virgin. Died a virgin. You never can know about those things, but I've never read any assertions that there was sex in her life in the overt sense. There's a lot of conjecture about her sexual life, because she was an extremely ardent person. Let's move to some of the poems where some of that appears a little more.
Okay.
Yes, sir, please.
Was she sickly?
No, she was not really sickly. She was actually rather a healthy person. She had a problem with her eyes when she was younger, and that presented her with the need for care of her eyes. But on the whole, she was a rather healthy person until very late in her life. So that was not a cause for her withdrawal from the world. And probably most of you know, if you know anything about her, that she withdrew pretty much completely from the world.
At a much advanced age?
Well, it was a gradual process.
Oh.
It was a gradual process. But by the age of 30 or so, she pretty much was not appearing in society.
You're kidding.
Yeah, and by the age of 35 to 40, she pretty much didn't even appear to visitors to her home.
My goodness.
Visitors would come to see her and she would talk to them from upstairs.
How old was she when she died?
She was, let's see, she died in 84, she was 44.
What did she die of?
44.
Only 44?
Yeah, she was born in 40, and she died in 84, yeah.
My goodness.
So she was not she didn't live very long. Her death was, it was a kind of a complicated series of illnesses. There's conjecture about that too. It's not exactly certain.
Getting back to the poem again, in actuality, the bee could care less.
How do you know?
He was after something else besides sex.
How do you know? Are you a bee?
Well, no, the point is that his objective, the bee's objective, is to get the honey, and in the process, picks up the pollen, which he carries by nature to the next one to pollinate.
That's scientifically true. But I wonder if you and I could have a heart-to-heart talk with a bee.
After he's been educated.
After the bee's been educated. Here's a poem that shows a kind of a healthy, I would say, sensuality. Written to whom we don't know. Assumedly man. My river runs to thee, blue sea, wilt welcome me? My river awaits reply. O sea, look graciously. I'll fetch thee brooks from spotted nooks. Say, sea, take me. Lovely, lovely kind of giving poem. Now here's a scandalous poem. It's basically the same, very much the same metaphor. Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart, rowing in Eden. Ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee. Pretty scandalous poem, huh? Written in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. You see here a person who understands love, physical love, what it means, even though she assumedly didn't experience it herself. She knew what the world was about. The image of the sea is very often used for a sex act. And she has picked it up and I think done with it. I think it's a lovely poem. It's a strong poem. It's a strongly erotic poem. It reminds you of some of Walt Whitman's poetry, which was also strongly sensual. She was writing at the same time as Walt Whitman. There, the contrasts and comparisons between those two is a fascinating task. And when I teach American literature, I usually teach both of their poetry, the poetry of both of them, and like to talk about them and the contrast between them. She being, in a poem like this, utterly feminine, and he in so many respects being utterly masculine in his approach, even though his sexual predilections were assumedly homosexual. Another one, very conventional poem here, Imagination. I'm wife. I finished that other state. I'm czar. I'm woman now. It's safer. So, how odd the girl's life looks behind this soft eclipse. I think that Earth seems so to those in heaven now. This being comfort then, that other kind was pain. But why compare? I'm wife. Stop there. This was assumedly written at one of the times in her life when she was very much in love, and there is evidence that probably three times, almost certainly twice, she was very, very much in love and would have loved to be married. And this poem is the poem of a young woman, she was a young woman when she wrote it, who wanted very much to be married, and who imagined what the state would be like, what her status would be like, what her feeling about the world would be if she were to be married. An exalted state to a woman in the 19th century. It wasn't really much of a place for a single woman in the 19th century, I'm telling you things you know. Particularly in a small New England town, what was she to do? What was her service to be beyond the mundane services, the homely services of taking care of the house and serving her family? She found a vocation. She was extraordinary. But she wasn't, when she wrote this poem, she wasn't sure that would happen. Her vocation was to be a poet. But through her search for a life, one of the things that she faced, as every woman did in the 19th century, was if you do not marry, you are a spinster. You work at the distaff side. Your role is very limited. Your function in society is circumscribed. And therefore, the status, just the sheer status of a woman who is married is exalted. She is czar. Czarina, assuming. She would be queen compared to that girlish state. I'm wife, I finished that other state, that girl's state. I'm czar, I'm woman now. It's safer so. It's safer, I'm protected, right? I'm protected in the world. Otherwise I may be bereft, as in a way her sister and she were when their parents died and their brother moved away and married, and the two of them were in a house alone. And if one had lost the other, then they would have been quite unprotected. How odd the girl's life looks behind this soft eclipse. Marriage is a soft eclipse. Isn't that a wonderful metaphor for a young woman in the 19th century? I think that Earth seems so to those in heaven now. Those who are in heaven now must look on their earthly life the way I, a married woman, now look on my my virgin years as an unmarried woman. It's a very insightful poem.
Can I ask?
See, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Three questions I have.
Yeah.
How old was she when she started writing poetry? Is there any reason why she didn't get married?
Yeah, let me why don't I take those two and then I'll go on. She really wrote poems in the sense of these small, kind of gnomic, sometimes two-line poems when she was a little girl to her girlfriends. And indeed then, when she was a teenager, she would write them to her family when they were away from home, often inserting them. So she was a poet from her very earliest years. Why didn't she marry? Well, I brought along to Holden about 10 books about Emily Dickinson, many of which spent a lot of time exploring them. She wasn't a pretty young woman. She wasn't a conventionally attractive young woman. She wasn't the kind of girl who got lots of attention from boys when she was a kid. On the other hand, she had a certain degree of popularity because she was a delightful, charming person. On the other side, however, she tended to frighten the boys away because of her extraordinarily powerful presence. The energy that she channeled into her poetry in her earlier years was channeled into the social relations which she had and subsequent letters, which were often terribly off-putting to those poor country oafs around Amherst, Massachusetts. They didn't know what in the world to make of her. She would write these lovely little letters, which we find delightful today, I do, but they would flee. They would flee in terror. Indeed, one of the few men that she really had a close relationship with later in her life was Thomas Higginson, Civil War general, minister, publisher, who first brought her out as a poet, one of the people who first brought her out as a poet, by writing an article in the Atlantic Monthly, which said, "Young writers, bring me your work and state what you want to state and send it to me and I'll see if I can't get it published." And she responded immediately like a fish to the bait. And they established a friendship. He was enormously helpful to her and was one of the two people who published her poems when she died. He came to visit her twice and he said to his wife, "She pulls the energy away from me in a way that no one else ever has. I'm glad I don't live near her."
Yeah.
Which is not to say that she wasn't charming, it's to say she was too charming. Mm-hmm. So she really put boys off when she was a young, eligible girl. Subsequently, she had two very complicated relationships with men. In both cases, the men were married. And we're talking 19th century, that was then just not thinkable that it would happen. Then the third real love of her life, if we can sort out all of the stories on her and make sense of them, and I think we're well on the way to being able to do that now because there's so much material that we have to work with, was late in her life. He was a Supreme Court Justice in the Massachusetts Court, and both the husband and the wife in this case, his name was Otis Lord, and both the husband and the wife were close to Emily. She really fell in love with him, and he in a measure with her, but they were very correct. However, then Lord's wife died. Then it was possible. And then there was a flood of love letters going back and forth, but it was really too late. It was really too late for both of them at that point. So it's not an easy answer to a very good question. You had a third one.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why then did she become a recluse? Was it because of these loves that found?
Yeah, clearly that had an influence. There really, I talked last night, when we talked about her poems about God, about her problem with going forward, with being a committed Christian, which she never could bring herself to do. And some of her tracking her poems wrestling with this problem is clearly a signal that that was one reason for her withdrawal. Refusing to be a committed Christian in Amherst, Massachusetts in the 1950s meant that you were pretty close to being a pariah. You were just not one of us. And she turned against the religion then in a very strong way as she grew older, when she saw the hypocrisy that this kind of Puritanism running downhill, which is what Amherst was, which what New England was in her time. People could not measure up to the Old Testament God standards, and they tended to pretend that they were measuring up, and so the hypocrisy was rampant. If we think our society is hypocritical, it's nothing as hypocritical as was hers. So she turned away from it. So clearly it had to do with religion. Clearly it had to do with the society was so religiously oriented. It had been for decades and decades, you would call it theocracy, where the heads of the church were heads of the town also, that she turned against the society because it was so hypocritical in her view. Clearly, her not finding a man to be married to, starting her own family, had an effect. And then she saw her vocation being to be a poet. And she became so immersed in that absorbing work, she's the best we've produced, so her judgment is right, that she had no time for anything else. That's hard to imagine that that's what she did, but it is what she did. And the 1,775 poems she left are what she did instead of being social. It was not all that extraordinary, it should be said at that time, for women in the 19th century in a small New England town to be recluses. Indeed, her sister Lavinia, close sister, who found all her poems after Emily had died, a miracle, there they were, she found them. Her sister Lavinia, when asked about her sister's being a recluse and not leaving her room most of the time, to say nothing, not leaving her house, it gave a wonderful, wonderful New England answer. She said, "It was just a happen. It was just a happen. That's just the way it turned out." She just gradually. It was very gradual. It was quite gradual. Mm-hmm. Now I want to move to some of the poems which are closer to these are kind of telling her attitude on love, conventional man-woman love. But because she was unhappy in love, she lived a life of renunciation, if you please. And I want to just share a couple of these. But I want to choose them because I've gone too long now with this. I want to choose them with care. Okay, here is one that she wrote to one of her lovers. We're not sure to whom. This is probably to a minister who was married, who was in Philadelphia, and she visited him and heard him preach and fell in love with him. The marriage was impossible, although there was evidence that he reciprocated the affection. He left Philadelphia for San Francisco. Now, in the 1850s, to go to the 60s, to go to San Francisco was to go to the end of the world. Mm-hmm. Never going to see him again.
Wicked place.
And a wicked place to boot. But she didn't have any worry about that. It'd be all right. So here's what she wrote, assumedly about him and his disappearing from the face of the earth and his being married, and therefore nothing could come of the relationship. "If you were coming in the fall, I'd brush the summer by with half a smile and half a spurn, as housewives do a fly. If I could see you in a year..." Actually, I think this one is in your poem.
It's on the last page.
It's on the last page. So let's get a look at it so you can have the fun of sharing it. Somebody else want to read it? Would you like to read it? But you can read it better than I can.
Go on.
Go ahead.
Come on, you've been at it a few years.
Go ahead, but I like the way you read it. Okay.
If you were coming in the fall, I'd brush the summer by with half a smile and half a sperm, as housewives do a fly. If I could see you in a year, I'd wind the months in balls and put them each in separate drawers for fear the numbers fuse. If only centuries delayed, I'd count them on my hand, subtracting till my fingers dropped into Van Diemen's land. If certain when this life was out that yours and mine should be, I'd tossed it yonder like a rind and take eternity. But now, uncertain of the length of this that is between, it goads me like the goblin bee that will not state its sting.
Yeah. Comments on that one?
I don't know if I'm just ignorant or what, but I don't know what Van Diemen's Land is.
Good. Good question. Fair question. We dealt in our last session with her reference to Brazil in a poem. And
Tunis.
And then we've dealt the previous session with another poem that dealt with Tunis. Why Tunis? Why Brazil? Why Van Diemen's Land? She often used these expressions to mean something very far away, very exotic. She probably didn't know.
Timbuktu.
Yeah, we didn't know where it was. Didn't have any idea, but it was the end of the earth. And that, I think, is what we're dealing with here. How about the last line? It goads me like the goblin bee that will not state its sting. Why state?
You get a bee on and you don't know, you know darn well you're going to get stung, you don't know when.
You don't know when.
And this is what she's saying. If I don't know where you're going to be, how am I going to contain myself?
Exactly, exactly. What it reminds me of whenever I read it is not the bee so much as the mosquito at night in the summertime in your room. Sting me, just sting me, I don't care how much it itches.
And get it over with.
But if it's going to be all night long, it's only 11 o'clock at night now and I've just gone to bed and you're going to be around here all night long. It's going to make the evening interminable. The night is never going to end. So the statement of the sting is taking the action, actually coming forward and biting and not waiting. It seems to me this poem does just beautifully the problem of something that's never going to happen in eternity. Even if it couldn't be in this life, if she could have had Charles Wadsworth as a future lover, a minister with whom she was in love, if it could be, we cannot, you and I cannot have any kind of relationship, any degree of satisfaction in this life, but in the next life. But you see, in the confines of the Christian ethic of her time, even the thought of that, he was married to somebody else, and it was a good marriage. So she had no right even to think of that, you see. To say nothing of, if you were coming in the fall, if I could see you in a year, if only centuries delayed, if in the next life.
Yes.
I could deal with any of those. I could deal with any of those. No matter how long I had to wait, my patience is infinite. But if it can never happen, or probably never, yeah. Probably never, like the bee, may not bite, may not happen, but it's there as a possibility. Powerful, powerful. Let's see what else I've got on here. I like the one at the bottom of 10, although it's not strictly on love. I don't want to get through the course without having a chance to read that one. Somebody want to share that one with us, the bottom of page 2, of page 10, number 8?
I love the look of agony, because I know it's true. Men do not sham convulsion nor simulate a throe. The eyes glaze once, and that is death. Impossible to feign. The beads upon the forehead by homely anguish strung.
Okay. What do you make of that? I like a look of agony because I know it's true. What a gutsy thing. Do you like a look of agony? I don't like a look of agony. I don't like a look of agony.
And if you've got if you've got a look of real agony, you really are in agony. You're not feigning that.
Exactly. There is no simulation.
There's no sham.
If you see somebody who's hurt, particularly if you've seen the event that brings it about, I suppose the best actors on the stage can simulate it in a way that's effective, but the kind of look that she's talking about, you cannot sham. Mm. This is one of the most powerful of her poems against the hypocrisy of her time. Against the hypocrisy of everybody appearing to be upright, righteous, correct, in God's grace, always under control. She didn't accept that. She wanted to have the way it is appear. But it's such a courageous thing to say.
She threw in another word here, throw.
Yeah. What's a throw? What's a throw?
I think of epileptic.
Yeah, type. Yeah, it's a fit. A throw is a fit. Mm-hmm. You simulate a throw, and to simulate a throw is next door to impossible. Yeah. So when you see that, you know it's absolutely real. It's absolutely real. She dealt with that kind of raw emotion. Kind of reminds me of Henry James, who was a contemporary of hers. She didn't read his stuff. They were about the opposite, because he was as prolix as she is concise. But Henry James one time was seen at a funeral house, the house of a person who died, and the wake was held. And this was a house in which he had been unwelcome. He was not on speaking terms with the members of the family. And he said, "Henry, why are you here?" And he said, "Where emotion goes, there go I." In other words, that kind of artist who needs to see the way the world really is, not through hypocrisy, but the way it really is, has to expose himself or herself to the way it really is in order to be able to write about it. Let's see what else we have among these that we haven't. I'm going to read one to you. That's the heartbreaker of heartbreakers. It's not a long poem. She never wrote any long poems. Indeed, somebody said, Edgar Allan Poe, I think, there's no such thing as a long poem. A poem becomes long as the longer poem. But this is as long as she ever wrote them. This is maybe among the first half dozen of poems with respect to their fame, and some of you probably know it. But this is the poem of renunciation. I cannot live with you, it would be life. And life is over there behind the shelf the sexton keeps the key to. Putting up our life is porcelain like a cup, discarded of the housewife, quaint or broken. A new Sevres pleases, old ones crack. I could not die with you, for one must wait to shut the other's gaze down. You could not. And I, could I stand by and see you freeze without my right of frost, death's privilege? Nor could I rise with you, because your face would put out Jesus's. That new grace grow plain and foreign on my homesick eye, except that you than he shone closer by, they'd judge us. How? For you served heaven, you know, or sought to. I could not. Because you saturated sight, and I had no more eyes for sordid excellence as paradise. And were you lost, I would be, though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame. And were you saved, and I condemned to be where you were not, that self were hell to me. So we must keep apart. You there, I here, with just the door ajar that oceans are, and prayer, and that pale sustenance, despair. This was assumedly written again for Charles Wadsworth, who was a minister, you see, there's internal evidence, because you served God and I could not. The despair that's there, the sense of never being able to come together, is so aching. It's an aching poem. And it reminds us that although she wrote interesting poems about love and the joy of love, some of her most powerful poems are those which have to do with foregoing love, with giving love up. Finish just by taking a look at this at this brief one, which I use for the title. Love is anterior to life, posterior to death, initial of creation, and the exponent of breath. Now this, I think, is love in a much broader sense. This is love, all the kinds of love. This isn't necessarily man-woman love, which I've concentrated on here particularly today, because I think that's the most interesting poems have to do with that. But this is love of any kind, love for family. The idea that love is there, love is an entity before we're born, that love goes on after death, this leads to gratitude toward immortality. That it is initial of creation, initial, I think, here being used as initiator, the spark of creation, the spark of love. The spark of creation is love. And the exponent of breath, that which explains, which justifies breath. Love is everything. Love is before, after, spark plug, and excuser of everything.
She must have had a little bit of mathematics, using the word exponent.
She had a little bit of everything, and we don't know where it came. That's the fascinating thing about her. The most fascinating thing about her of all is how in the world, as you and I have discussed before, how in the world did she know so much?
Yes.
How could she?
And have all that and write all that and die at 44.
Although if she was, you know, sequestered off in a room somewhere, maybe her life just became her dictionary or something.
Her dictionary, she was a reader, the Bible, the dictionary, and Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Perhaps in the order, the Bible, Shakespeare, and the dictionary. Those were her three major, but she read a lot. She read Ralph Waldo Emerson, she read Scott, she read a lot. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can get a certain amount from reading, but I don't think you can know everything that she knew. I mean, I wouldn't have thought so. That's why she's a miracle. She is nothing short of a miracle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, there are some. Let's see. There's one major picture. Let me see if I've got. Fred, I didn't bring the biography along. It's got the best picture.
Okay.
She was not a beauty. This is a drawing based on the one picture which we had. I want to see if I've got it here. The book that I've got that's got the pictures in it is a big, heavy biography, so I've taken not to carrying it around. But it has the one really good picture which we have of her.
What's the name of this big, heavy biography, and who wrote it?
Yeah, it's written by a man named Richard Sewell, S-E-W-E-L-L, Richard Sewell's biography of Emily Dickinson. It's in two volumes. The first volume, picture if you will, doesn't talk about Emily Dickinson per se. It talks about her father, her grandfather, her mother, her sister, her brother's wife, her closest friends, Thomas Higginson, Mabel Loomis Todd, the two people who published her poems first and her letters. So that's the first volume. So you read that and you just can't wait. And then you go to the second volume and start to talk about Emily Dickinson herself. It's a beautifully organized book. It's one of the two best literary biographies I know. Marvelous. Richard Sewell, S-E-W-E-L-L. Yeah. This is also a very good one, a briefer one. This is by Thomas Johnson. And this was, for years, considered the authoritative, the best of all. And it is awfully good. And if you want to start with something a little less imposing, this interpretative biography by Thomas Johnson is also very good. It's a little dated, but it's a beautiful book. This was written in 55. The Sewell was written more in the mid 70s. So this is also very good. There are lots of good books on her. Lots of good books.
Did her sister know that she was writing?
No, her sister really didn't know what a serious poet she was. Her sister knew that she played at poetry. Her brother had some idea about that also, but that she had written 1,775 poems. And that when she finished them, she would sew them together in little paper booklets and put them in her bureau drawer. So that when she died, Lavinia, her sister, went and there they were. And she was thunderstruck. She was not herself a very astute critic of poetry, and this poetry was, we haven't even gone into that today, this poetry was crazy poetry. People didn't have any idea what to make of it. I mean, it didn't rhyme. The rhythms, internal rhythms of the poem were sometimes seemed crazy, not sensible. There was always a reason for it. Always a reason for what she did. So that even Thomas Higginson and Mabel Loomis Todd looked at them and said, I don't know what's happening here. I forget where I was going with that. In any event, she left them all there. So Lavinia saw them and realized right away, we've got to try to get these published, even though she couldn't really see the merit. No, she didn't know what a serious poet she was.
If they didn't know that she was a serious poet, then what did they think that she was doing? Most of the time we were
writing crazy stuff, I suppose.
Writing letters. She was a prolific correspondent, and she would write drafts of letters and send them off. It was a very private family. Each one had, Higginson said, each one has his or her, each member of the family has his or her own fiefdom. They do their own thing, and they don't necessarily interrelate very much. Mm-hmm. The family doesn't. A lot of respect, a lot of privacy. So they didn't necessarily know, but Emily's all right. They were alone. She'll be okay.
Her own thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is she the first of the children to die?
Yes, she was the first of the three children to die, yes. And then the brother died. The brother's story is a whole other thing. One of these columns here is about the brother. Brother, he was very, very close to Emily. Was a fascinating man. He was the number one person in the town. The leader of the town. He was the treasurer of Amherst College, which was the institution in the town. He was the leader of the Unitarian Church. He was a very strong figure. A very unhappy man. That's another book about him, which I would recommend to you at some point. It's in the column.
What would you recommend for a commentary for a beginner of Emily Dickinson's poems?
The book right there is a very good one. 20th Century Views is a series of the best essays about her poetry.
Okay. And that's by Sewell, too.
That's edited by Sewell.
Oh, edited.
By Richard Sewell.
Okay.
Yeah. It's first class. And his introduction to that book is a very good way to start on her poetry, except, of course, the best thing of all is the poetry itself. And the poetry itself, I should have made a plug. The best book of her poetry that I know of is Final Harvests. This is edited by Thomas Johnson, who wrote the biography. And this is available in the bookstore here at Holden Village. That's a plug.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Excellent. It's got the best selection.
They only have a few left.
They've only got a few left. Right. They're going like hotcakes. This is the same book which I bought when it first came out. And I've mentioned several times that it's kind of an indication of our inflation. I bought this when it first came out in the early 60s for $1.95. It'll now cost you $9.95. Same book exactly, except a different cover. The same introductory essay by him. He's very good, too.